they're like, do you want to do a stand-up gig at some golf course in Connecticut? And I was like, all right, sure. And it's all the Rangers. Kenny Albert is hosting. It's like the Rangers and Coca-Cola. And I go up there and I am bombing. It's going so, they won't laugh at anything I say. It's going so bad. At one point I was like, give it up for Coca-Cola. And they're just like, all right. Adam Graves walks up to me, and I love Adam Graves. I mean, I grew up being a Rangers fan. How do you not love Adam Graves? And he's searching. You can tell he's searching for something positive to say, but there's nothing good to say. So Adam goes, I love humor. I'm like, that's all you could give me? I love humor. That's how bad I was.
Hello, everyone. I'm Henrik Lundqvist, your host here at Club 30. We're coming to you from New York City.
Magic New York. I'm Jay Liddell. Good to see everybody. Welcome back, Hank.
Yeah, thanks. Good week?
Yeah. I mean, I could complain, but nobody listens to me.
Could be a little bit better, but it could be worse,
you know,
too.
You know, one of my pet peeves is like when you ask somebody how somebody is, and they're like, I'm so busy. I'm like, oh, really? You're busy? What's that feel like? You know, like, whoa.
What does that feel like?
Yeah, it was a normal New York week, you know, lots of stuff going on, but grateful for all of it.
So on our show today, Sam Morril, great stand-up comedian. He's crushing it right now with the different specials on TV. He has his podcast.
How did we get him on the show? I mean, I know he has a studio right next to us, but...
Yeah, so I met him a few weeks ago at The Garden. He was performing at Garden of Laughs.
Oh, nice. Yep.
Theater of Madison Square Garden, charity night. And he was awesome. And we start talking about, hey, why not get this guy on?
Yeah.
So being a stand-up comedian, I mean, it must be nerve-wracking. I have a few questions lined up here about what do you really feel being up on a stage? Would you be able to do it, Jay?
No, I think my toxic trait is that I believe I can do anything. And I, as I've gotten older, I've taken some, you know, humble pie, but I've always obsessed about how much they command the room, you know, and it's always just impressed me how these guys and girls can get up and, you know, be self-deprecating and timed really well and like at least appearing calm, because it's a tough crowd too, you know, when you have hecklers and you have people.
Are you good at telling jokes? Like I have no problem talking in front of an audience and people, but if someone tells me, hey, tell us a joke, I'm blanking.
Like, I can't do that. I'm more observational. I find everything in the world funny, and I usually have like pithy, annoying comments that I think are funny based on what I'm seeing, but I can't remember one joke.
No.
Like not even a dad joke, and I'm a dad now.
Maybe I should start writing them down in my phone just so I have a feel, you know, in the back. But listen, New York City, it's a great place for stand-up.
Yeah.
A lot of comedy sellers and opportunities to see some of the best in the business.
Yeah. Have you had any memorable nights out in New York that involved stand-up?
I've seen a few. There's been a few shows at The Garden, actually, that I watched. It was awesome. But also some smaller places. John McEnroe has this charity event, comedy charity event. And it's been some great acts there.
Yeah.
But again, just not knowing if it's going to be good or bad.
Yeah. You know? Totally.
The excitement around that. Ooh.
Yeah, I remember a couple of years ago, there's this place in the Village called Cafe Wa, which is a live music venue, and a bunch of us were just hanging out there, and there's all this kind of commotion in the background, because Comedy Cellar's, I think, right next door, two doors down, and there's all this rumor started going through the crowd that somebody big was going to show up at Comedy Cellar, which often happens in New York, which is awesome. And so we kind of paid our tab and bought cover tickets to the Comedy Cellar. And I think it was Chris Rock and Chappelle showed up to work on new material. And that's one of those things where you just thank yourself that you decided to move to New York. Because it feels so special where these legends of comedy will just show up at Gotham or Comedy Cellar and kind of hone their material for the, you know, it's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, the city, you have comedy, you have sports, music, entertainment, and fashion. And then in terms of like top shows for you, in the past, is there anything that
that was one of them for sure because of the surprise of it, like the unexpected part of the night.
Unexpected.
You know, you have like a plan, and you think this is the perfect plan. We're going to get together, have drinks, and listen to tunes, and then it takes this right turn into, you know, sitting laughing your ass off at Chris Rock and Dave Chappelle. Like that unexpected part of it's good, and then the other one I'd put up next to that same theme, unexpected, is that there was like some corporate event down at the Capitol. It was like this old bank on Bowery. Event turned into an event space. And my friend, one of my good buddies was like, this is going to be a big night. Like, I think a couple big acts are going to perform. And we walked in and there's probably like 90-100 people. And Kanye comes out in like a silver suit and he opens, does like a 40-minute open set for the Strokes. And this is back in like 2004.
Yep.
Right around like pre-college dropout, right when the Strokes were hitting it big. And it was just one of those things like, I cannot believe I am here in New York City and this is happening. So those are the kind of the two.
Yeah.
How about you?
I'm trying to think of like, I've seen so many great shows at the Garden music wise. I also love Broadway. I love people when they're performing. Yeah. I respect
sure.
any type of performance because you understand that what you go through to prepare for it. And it doesn't matter if it's stand up or Broadway or rock and roll at yeah. MSG.
Yeah.
Just to get to that level, being able to perform at a high level. And I'm so impressed with especially the music part of it.
Yeah.
But top shows, man, that's tough. I remember watching Pearl Jam at MSG.
Yeah.
It was a 9/11 tribute night. That was a great show. Really yeah. good show. And they had a ton of first responders there. And yeah, that sticks out to me.
Yeah.
Just to have the opportunity to check out so many different venues and acts,
yeah.
I think is awesome.
I know Sam grew up, he was born and raised here in New York. So I'm really interested to hear like how that, like the city shaped his act and, you know, what it's like to cut your teeth as a comedian here in New York, because obviously there's like all these legends were kind of born and raised here. So it'll be cool to just to get to understand how that worked.
Let's get him on.
Let's get him.
Sam Morrell. You've seen his specials on Comedy Central and Netflix. He's performed on Jimmy Fallon, Conan, and every other late night show. He tours all over the country, and you can also find him on his popular podcast, We Might Be Drunk. And there's no topic he's afraid to address on Hot Mic, so buckle up. Welcome to Club 30, comedian Sam Morrell.
Thank you.
Yo.
Thanks for being here.
Good to be you. Here, man. I ran in the rain. I was sprinting. I didn't want to get wet. So yeah.
Well, A for effort. Hey, listen, when I say stand-up comedian, something happens in me. I get a little nervous. I think we all been in a room where we've seen great acts and there's acts where you just get so uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah.
Do you love that uncomfortable feeling in a room?
You learn to love it. Like the way you train, right? You're like, it's not fun to lift weights, but or maybe you like it. I don't know. But you're doing that stuff. I mean, I thought you were going to go the other way. I thought you were going to be like, man, how do you do? I get this all the time from athletes. Like, how do you do comedy? And I'm like, dude, you're a goalie.
Yeah.
That's harder.
But that is fair. But to me, just being in a room, first of all, like, are you nervous when you're up there?
No, not really.
No?
There's a couple. I was a little nervous at that Garden of Laughs gig that you introed me. It was you and Mike Richter
intro'd yes.
me. I was a little nervous. There's a lot of childhood favorites in the room. Hmm. I'm like, man, I don't want to bomb in front of John Starks, you know? Something sad about that. But I'm in the weird phase now. I just burned an hour that's going to come out July 9th. And I'm kind of bad right now. I have to write a new act. So it's trial and error. You kind of just have to bomb a little bit. So I get a little, not nervous, but you learn to love the worst parts of the show or yeah. else you can't do it, right? Yeah.
So what's the feeling you're looking for when you go out on stage? Are you pumping yourself up or do you want to be calm? Or how do you feel really good walking out on stage?
Definitely calm. If I see a comic like doing push-ups before, I'm like, that guy's a hack. That guy stinks. No, you want to be calm. You don't want to force it. I mean, like any conversation, I think if a person's too much, you kind of like dial it back.
Yeah.
So I want to be calm. Like whenever you see Chris Rock pop into the Comedy Cellar downtown, he's very low energy because I think he wants to make sure the joke is going to do the heavy lifting. Wow. And then if he's in a theater or an arena, he brings the energy. But you save it for when you know the joke is killer. I think you test the joke at a lower energy and then you bring the confidence
at a later date. How do you know if you're funny? Like, do you have a test person when you do your jokes at home? You do.
I have a friend who I text. I'm like, he's not a comic. I'll text comics too, but along the lines of like, have you heard this bit? If it's a comic, has this been done before? You know, to make sure I'm not doing someone else's act. You know, but yeah, I have a friend named Chase who he's like my go-to for, is this good? Is this sincere? sometimes I'll be too hard on myself. And he's like, this isn't swaggy, Sam. You got to be, you're a cooler guy than that. And yeah. I'm like, but we don't feel cool, you know?
But is he funny?
Chase? He is funny.
He is funny.
Yeah.
So you trust him. If he tells you, Sam, hey, listen, that's not a good joke.
But. Oh, he'll just write meh back or something. He'll be like, that stinks. I like Chase. He's honest. Yeah. He's I had another friend who used to write, ugh, and I was like, ugh, is too far. Meh, I can do, but ugh is like, that's like an attack on my character.
How do you spell, I don't even know how you spell that.
U-G-H.
Oh, yeah. Ugh. On the awkward thing, do you think it's correlated a little bit, the appreciation of the awkward with old age? Because as I've gotten older, maybe it's young age when I was so insecure, I was just trying to, you know, get with girls or impress people. I was terrified of those awkward moments.
Yeah.
And for me, like Curb, like watching Curb made me really appreciate like the really awkward.
Yeah, I mean, he really embraced it. That's the look. Awkward is I would go on morning shows and just make it painful. Awkward to me is funny when it was so when it's so scripted. Like, you know, when you're having a regular conversation, I'm like, what's the point of me going on a morning show and being sincere? They're asking right. like the most obvious stuff, and it's like this weird
say
box
something
you're in.
Funny.
So the only way I would find morning shows funny if I would just drill a hole in it and make it so painful. And usually they hate. Usually it's the morning show host, the guy they usually hate. I found. Because he can never, the women usually can take a joke and the guys can't. So whenever I'd get off the set, the staff would be like, I hate my boss so much. Thanks for doing that. You know, I mean, in Utah, this guy tried to big dog me and he's like, you're going to mess with us on air? Because he had seen my clips. I'm like, you guys invited me on. I mean, you guys got to know what I'm going to do. But he kept messing with me. And then when I messed with him, he was like, you're not allowed back. And I was like, I'll try to bounce back from being banned from Good Morning Salt Lake. We'll see if I can, my career can recover. But I do love going on them because they're uncomfortable.
Yeah. So you do love the uncomfortable. You're seeking it.
Not in stand-up, but on the morning shows. In stand-up, I want the bit to be polished, and I want to, you know, I want it to be perfect. You know, we're in a world now
where you have a lot of audience engagement, though, too, where you kind of, it feels like you're looking for a little, I don't know.
Yeah. When people heckle me, people think I look for it. I don't look for it. I'll do an hour of stand-up. And then, like, the crowd work is almost like dessert. It's, like, extra. It's, you know, I want them to feel like they got a good show. And then I'll mess with them a little bit. What I do a lot is I say, if you got a problem, scream it out, and I'll help. And I just kind of therapy roast them, essentially. Yeah. Like, I appreciate that they're willing to share something so personal. I had a guy recently yell out, I said, what's your problem? And he said, my ex-girlfriend's in the crowd. And I was like, get the hell out. I thought he was messing with me. She was there. She started, we got a back and forth. We got to why they broke up. He was a realtor. She dumped because he doesn't make enough money. And I was like, you're on a date with a new guy. And I was like, what do you do? And he said, I'm a realtor. And I was like, look out. There's going to be a better realtor, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, you get some, people share stuff that I'm shocked they share.
What's the craziest that has happened that we can actually talk about on this show?
I've had protesters there, and you just kind of like, now is not a time for jokes. And I'm like, I'm at the Omaha Funny Bone. Like, what do you think? This is actually the absolute time I should be making jokes. So, yeah, you get all kinds of weird people, and you just have to roll with it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, people that are funny not necessarily laugh a lot. Do you laugh a lot?
Yeah, I laugh at the dumbest stuff, though. Yeah. I'm trying to think of the stuff that makes me laugh is like, you know, just slapstick, silly. Like, I was watching The Naked Gun the other day and I was dying laughing. Like, stuff like funny. That.
Yeah.
I mean, a good laugh. I feel like it's so good for your body. Like, the chemicals in your body change. It really, and I even try to fake laugh and it helps.
It's funny, you know, when you can tell.
I'm serious now.
I think you're 100% right. I think, you know, when someone's like frigid or uptight or something and they're rude, you're like, that person needs to get laid.
Right.
No one ever says that person needs to laugh, but they need to laugh sometimes.
Do you have a good fake laugh, Jay?
No, but because it's usually right before I was like, oh, fuck you. Like, I'm going to fuck yourself.
Yeah.
But really laugh.
I can laugh easily. I find a lot of things funny, mostly myself.
Yeah.
So I don't have the opportunity to fake laugh a lot unless I'm really being really like acerbic and sarcastic. I don't know. You?
You never need to fake laugh.
Not really. No. Sometimes you're on a podcast with your buddy and he's telling a story. You'll give him like a little laugh to get him some confidence to jumpstart something. But no, I don't really fake it.
No, there's some... Mike is
I hate
too
a fake
close.
Laugh. Like, I hate when you get like a ha in a text. Is there anything more?
I'm not talking about like ha ha. Yeah, that's funny. It's more like.
Oh, like a. Oh. See, that's funny.
Now I feel battery in my belly.
Yeah.
That was probably too loud. But it helps.
Yeah.
So I did a bit part in the movie Joker, and my friend Gary Goldman went on before me, and he's performing in the crowd. And you know the scene where Joaquin is going like,
Right.
They didn't tell him it was Joaquin Phoenix. So Gary's on stage, and he's about to snap at this guy. He's about to be like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Shut up. Because the guy keeps going, ah, ha, ha. And then he's like, that's okay, I'm just going to keep doing the bit. It's Joaquin Phoenix. It's part of the movie. He thought it was some extra messing with him. And
by the way, talking about awkwardness when he's up there, that scene is brilliant.
It's painful.
And you're up?
I was a guy before Joker when he's walking to the stage. The Joker comes for some reason, Todd Phillips kept in the movie. Give it up for Sam Morrell. I'm like, in the 1980s, in some weird DC universe, he decided to be like, well, Sam Morrell should exist there too.
Pull your phone out too.
No, it was crazy. No, they said, don't do it. It was funny. They were like, no phone material. The joke's got to work in the 80s. And I'm like, all right.
And when were you born? 1986.
86.
Right. Perfect.
Yeah.
When you came to the bench between plays, did you ever hear it from the crowd? Like, heck, where's the...
Yeah, of course. Of course you heard stuff. But it was more, I think, walking on and off the ice, because that's when you don't have the glass to separate players from fans, right?
Right.
So then they can really get in your face a little bit with comments. And
what's the worst you've ever been rattled?
I honestly don't remember.
Yeah.
There was definitely certain places that were tougher in terms of what they were saying.
The city?
Yeah.
Like, what city's the worst? Philly?
Yes. Philly was always the toughest one.
That's what I'm kind of proud of.
But I kind of enjoyed that environment.
Yeah.
That love-hate relationship between New York and Philadelphia and the fans. And as a player, I appreciated that, you know, it was a war.
Yeah.
You know, going to those games. There was something special about that.
Yeah, Philly's up there for me. I think they're like, if you get a bad drunk Philly crowd, Florida and Philly are the two like wild cards.
Right.
You know, like Florida could be great as a crowd, but they could also, you could get, good thing about Florida is you can't offend these people. They don't groan at anything. You know, no one in Florida is like, what did you, no, they'll laugh at anything.
Can you think of, I assume as a stand-up comedian, it happens, but you have these jokes, you just, this is going to be so good. I'm going to crush it with, and it doesn't resonate at all with the audience.
Yeah, you get jokes where you're like, this is too personal. This is too, like something can be funny to you that's not yet funny to them.
Yeah.
Or maybe sometimes you get it at the perfect moment. Like if it's a topical joke and the turnaround is quick, they give you an extra laugh. Like I remember literally 3 days after the Boston bombing, I said, you know, how devastated I was. And I was like, man, me and my brother, we don't do anything together anymore. That was a joke, and it crushed, because it was like, they thought it was going to be sincere, and of course I was devastated by it, but the joke was more like, my family life is messed up, I made it about me.
Yeah.
So that got a big pop, but then I've had jokes where like, you know, I have a joke that would always work is I said, you know, my biological father, people would say, is he a good father? And I said, if he were, I wouldn't refer to him as my biological father. That was a joke. So then that hits, but then you have jokes I tried that were like, that would upset them. I'd say, you know, I always tell them, don't get upset. I had a good childhood. My stepdad's a great dad. But when you, this is one that never worked. I said, you know, he would, when he legally adopted me from my stepdad, when he legally adopted me from my biological dad, you need the signature from the biological dad. So I said, it's like the opposite of a UPS package. You're like, here's my signature and I don't want this. Never worked. I think it made them too sad. So stuff like that, that's funny to me. I have a darker sense of humor about that stuff because I think how you deal with,
yeah,
personal stuff. You make jokes about it and it's like therapy. But that one may be too close to therapy. Like when I hear any entertainer like, this is my therapy, I'm like, well, you're doing it wrong. You're supposed to be making people laugh. So you got to pull the ones that are just for you and find a middle ground.
How much is timing? Like in terms of when you do it. And you read the room a lot. Like, okay, you're thinking in your head, I want to do this joke, but I don't think they're going to like it, and you kind of change your routine, or?
I don't really change it. Look, you adapt. Like when I did Garden of Laughs, I was like, I opened on a riff. I opened on a line that was not planned, you know? So they made like, you know, they raised over $2 million for this charity. And my first line was $2 million and it's all going to Diddy's legal defense fund. That was my first line. Got a big laugh. I took a risk and I was like, thank God. I
took a risk.
But I think they knew that was a risk. So they went with me, got a big pop, and then I went into my act. But I think when you can open on something they know is spontaneous, they respect it. And then it makes the whole act seem more spontaneous.
So mindset going up on stage, you want to connect with the audience as quick as possible. Is that the goal? Or
yeah, That's why comics will open with something self-deprecating or a quick one-liner. Like if you watch a late night set, a lot of the times they're doing, it's a quick joke, self-deprecating. You know, for years you have jokes that are like, this one's a silly joke making fun of me out of the gate. And that's the move, I think.
Yeah.
Because they know you can laugh at yourself. So they're now okay laughing with you.
You're from New York. You spent a lot of time here. When did you get into comedy? Like, and how did it start?
I got into comedy when I was pretty young. My parents sent me to a summer camp and I was voted funniest camper. So I think I got some confidence.
How old?
It's like 14.
Funniest camper? Yeah. 14.
I put on shows. I would do like plays and stuff that were like where I got to be the funny guy in them. So people loved them. And even the head of the camp when I was really young scolded me. He was like, I was like 10 years old. He's like, you grab your penis. And I was like, I'm doing a Michael Jackson impression. But he like didn't get it. And then by the end, he was like, you're actually kind of funny. I was like, all right, I won him over. So there's that transition of just making your you know, classmates or, you know, fellow campers laugh, whatever. And then you're like, can I make the adults laugh? Yeah. And in school, you know, I was a bad student for a while. And then as I got older, I became a good student. And it went from just making the classmates laugh to like making the teachers laugh. And I had a couple of teachers be like, oh, you're kind of funny. We did a presentation at our high school. You have to do community service followed by a presentation of the whole school. And I just turned mine into a stand-up routine and it killed. And I was like, oh my God, I'm on my way. And then I went to open mics and I bombed for years because they already liked me. That's the thing is like, you see if a celebrity goes up at the Comedy Cellar, they get that like few minutes of like, we like you already, so we'll go with you. Mm-hmm. But if you're unknown, you got to kill immediately. And I really found that out at open mics. And, you know, I would hand flyers out in the street. I would, you know, you've seen those guys in the street, to my show.
Yeah.
And then they go, holy shit, you're Henrik Lundqvist, you know? and he handed out the flyers and people would either pay you money or give you stage time, which I wanted the stage time. So, you know, but then you're going on for those people that watched you bark you into the show. You got them in and you're like, great lineup tonight. And then they're in the crowd and you go on, they're like, what the hell? This guy lied to us. So, you know, you bomb, but I always say it's like you bomb in the shadows. No one's seeing you bomb. So it's good. You're getting calluses on your skin. You're kind of okay with bombing. And then when you kind of stop, you kind of care, but not care at the same time. It's a weird combo being thin-skinned and thick-skinned. You got to take the rejection, but you got to also read the room and know what they're finding funny about you. So your friends, the goal is to tell stories on stage the way you would make a friend at a bar laugh, right?
Yeah.
But it takes time. And your friends at first are like, this isn't you. You're doing an impression of some other comedian you like, you know? But then over time, they're like, I just have friends not see me for like 3 years, then come to a show and be like, dude, you got good at this. Like, what the hell? They all thought I sucked for a while. And it sucks when your friends who are like, you should do comedy, so you do comedy. And they're like, maybe I was wrong. Yeah. But
do something else.
But then they come in a few years and they're like, it's almost like when you haven't seen a kid in a while and he grew like a foot. Mm-hmm. And you're like, what the hell? That's kind of what it feels like, where they're like, oh, you're like a different person, you know?
Did you have like a group of guys, girls during that open mic period that you kind of bonded with, all going through the same fall on your face experience?
Sure. I mean, Mark Norman, who I do a podcast with, was one of them. Yeah. And we're still friends. I'm trying to create a sitcom with another friend, Mike Lawrence. I mean, I stay friends with a lot of them. Gary Veeder, who he tours with me on the road. We've been on the tour bus and everything. We've done everything together. I met him because he cursed me out at an open mic because everyone snapped at mics. There was no way you didn't snap. I wasn't even mad when someone snapped because I was like, they're just doing a lot of mics. You're going to go crazy.
Yep.
You're turning into the Joker. Like, Gary went up and there were six people in this room called Maui Taco. And he saw me. I was tired. I was spacing out. And he saw me not paying attention. And when one person in a crowd of six isn't paying attention, it's tough.
Right.
So he goes, this asshole's not even listening. And I was like, oh. And I felt bad. I wasn't even mad he called me an asshole. So I was like, all right. Because I thought he had funny jokes. And then he was booked on a show I ran with a friend the next night. And Gary was like, I'm sorry about that. I said, I get it. Like, we all got it.
Yeah.
So, you lost it. I mean, you do enough bad gigs. I won a competition when I was like 23 or 24 in Atlanta called The Laughing Skull. And it changed my life because the prize was a year worth of road work. So I'm like, I'm a working comic all of a sudden. Like, I'm booked on the road. But they were bad clubs. So it's like, you get stronger, but you kind of develop hack tendencies when you're performing for bad audiences because you're just trying to survive. You're just trying to put on a good show.
Right.
And you want a smart crowd. And like, if you're getting like a bunch of drunks who don't really know comedy, you're just being like, you're just shutting them up and you get good with hecklers, but your material becomes too broad. You want to stay unique.
Yeah.
So what type of event is like the dream event for a stand-up comedy?
Well, I did the theater at MSG last year. I sold that out. So that was, for New York Kid, that was a big deal. So, you know, maybe the next one is the where you guys played. Yeah, maybe that's the next one. And I mean, it's just New York is, it just signifies like accomplishment in some way. You're like, oh, they say if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. Right. So something in New York, anything in New York, like I did the Beacon, that was special. Mm-hmm. Those gigs feel very special to me.
So as a kid, it was not like, okay, I'm going to be a stand-up comedian. It was more, it grew on you as you got older. And when you realized around 16, 17, 18, that, okay, I'm pretty good at this.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'd watch comedy movies. I'd watch stand-up. I mean, I Adam Sandler, Eddie Murphy, when you're growing up, Bill Murray. I was like, oh, I think I could be like the wise ass, you know? And then I just became obsessed with like New York stand-up. They would just say anything. And I think like, I one time heard Dave Chappelle say the youngest child is the truth teller, which I don't know if that's true, but I feel like you're like maybe less truth teller, more the tension breaker. So something awkward happens at the family table, the young one is the one who makes the joke usually because they're the youngest. They're kind of the most spoiled. They get away with everything. So, and I didn't get away with a lot. I got punished my whole childhood just for coming home drunk and being that kid, but I acted out. And I think for a long time, my parents were like, he chose comedy to get free drinks. That's why he chose his career. And I think for a period they were right. But then, you know, I got into this because I identified as like the screw up of my family. I was the black sheep. My brother and sister are lawyers and they were older and they were accomplished and I was younger. And I was like, well, I can't be the smartest. So I'll be the craziest. I'll be the funniest. Yeah. And then I was doing the shows and I really fell in love with it. And I was like, man, I have to work really hard. You see the guys you respect and they work so hard. And I'd hear interviews with comics I respect and I didn't realize, you know, like Louis C.K. ruined it for everybody by putting out an hour every year. Cause I was like, I have to put out an hour every year now.
Right.
But now, like you guys were mentioning crowd work, like you need to put even more out to retain an audience. Yeah, so it wasn't just an hour material. You do podcasts, you do late night, you do your special, but then you throw a crowd work clip out there. Anything to keep people like, oh yeah, I like this guy.
Yeah. Was it a good feeling when your siblings and parents came to the show and they're like, oh.
My siblings did not come to the MSG show because the overachievers they are, they ran the marathon the next day. I'm like, it's not, and my dad's like, all our kids accomplished a lot this weekend. I'm like, I can't have this weekend? Right, just you one? Can't give me selling out the MSG theater?
I have to ask you, like, when I assume they've been part of some of your jokes, like your family, your siblings, do you let them know that, hey, I'm actually going to talk about this and
no,
in case it comes out, you know, someone records it, it posts it online or whatever. And do you prepare like your closest that you might make fun of them? No.
No, I just tell them like, look, I love you guys. You're never really going to be portrayed in that bad a light. But the truth is, there's no point in telling someone because if you tell them, the joke might not make the act. And now you just got into a fight for no reason. That happened with ex-girlfriends where I was like, I have this idea for a joke about you. And she got furious. And then I tried the joke and it bombed. I'm like, well, that was worth it. Jesus Christ. So you can't really tell people. But yeah, I remember I had a joke about an ex where she got really mad. And I was like, this is a funny joke. And I kind of was just like, well, I'm doing it. I'm sorry.
You were still together when you did it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Oh, I mean, what am I going to reach out to an ex? That'd be even worse. Hey, just so you know, I'm zinging you in this new one.
Thinking about you. Hope everything's good.
But I said, you know, I had a joke about it. I forgot how it exactly goes, but it's like, you know, we're watching a movie I picked and she tried to have sex with me. And I was like, what the hell are you doing? And she goes, what? And I was like, you don't want to have sex with me during the movie? I said, I'll have sex with you during a movie you pick. This is one of my favorites, you know, like during Pride and Prejudice, I'll do it, not during Dog Day Afternoon, you know? So she didn't find that funny. It's weird. A lot of the jokes that you find, I would never disparage an ex in a way that's like cruel. I don't think that there's any point of that, but that's not the nature of my comedy. Like I'll be ball busty, but I mean, to just be mean is like the crowd won't like me. There's no point. That's a thought you maybe have, but then you brush it out. You know, so I have a ton of jokes about my mom's anxiety. She's always freaking out. She's always, I mean, my mom is the most stereotypically anxious Jewish woman that you could picture. Just like I mean, I think the joke about her that's the most popular is we were walking on the street once and we saw a dead pigeon and we looked at it and she goes, "Don't touch it." And I was like, "What do you think my life is like when you're not around? You think I'm just picking up dead animals? Like, no, I'm not going to touch the, like, I'm just going to pick it up and go, oh, this is cool." So that's the type of panic she does. She's always worried about me. And I'm just like, "Mom, it's going to be okay. It's going to be fine." You know, but I get it. She was a single mom for a while. So I think there's that, like, me and you against the world mentality I can't stop worrying. But.
And are you the youngest?
I'm the youngest, and I'm her only biological kid. You know, I'm in a blended family. So I think with that comes some discomfort. You know, my brother, sister, and dad are technically stepbrother and sister and stepfather, but I don't consider them that because they've been around since I was pretty young. So I just call them dad. I just call them my brother and sister. But, you know, when you blend a family, there's discomfort. And what breaks discomfort but jokes? And I'm the only one who doesn't realize I shouldn't be saying certain shit. So we'd be together and I would just, kids point out the obvious.
Right.
That's why kids are funny, because they will just say not the most thoughtful or careful thing, but just the obvious thing. And as an adult, you want to be a little more witty, but as a kid, you say that and you get laughs.
Yep.
So I was like, oh, this is a good reaction. They're much more quiet than my mom and I, my brother, sister, and dad they're quiet. So if I'd make jokes, I'd get a reaction out of them. So I was like, this is kind of cool.
And how is, with everything you got going now with tours and podcasts and stand up, how's a day in your life here in New York City? Are you writing in the mornings? You perform at night, or take us through your
I write. Your weeks. I exercise way more than I thought I ever would, but it's because I don't want to break down on the road. I did like 10, you know, when I wasn't. I'm flying usually first these days, so that's nice. But for a long time, I was, you know, middle seat, whatever the cheapest 6 a.m. flight was. So you're just falling. I'm 6'3". I'm falling asleep like this. I was like, you know, you get neck problems. So, you know, these days I try to, you know, I'll spend extra to make everything perfect. Nice hotel, fly well, you know, but.
How many days do you spend on the road?
I've done for many years, I think it was like 45 weeks a year. And, you know, I'm home during the week, but the weekends I'd be gone maybe Thursday through Sunday, Thursday through Saturday. But, you know, I did it a little more cautiously last year. You know, we did a tour bus, so you're able to bang out 14 cities in 14 days, which is pretty cool. I don't like nights off. My agent will be like, "We gave you Monday off." I'm like, "Well, fill it. You think I just want to be hanging out in a tour bus?" The tour bus is to get to each city, you know? So I'd be out for 14 days, but I'd be home for like a few weeks.
Okay.
And then, but I like the road. I need it. I mean, you feel, I would think as a professional athlete, I can only, you know, compared to like going to the gym, like it's fun to not go to the gym, but then after a while you're like, I feel bad about myself. I got to get in there.
Yeah.
So I'm good. I want to be good at comedy. And when you take time off, I see how rusty comedians get. If they take a writing job or they do something like that, they lose it a little. Huh. I think.
Is that something that's on offer for you now? Or are people coming to you and be like, right for this show?
No, like I would never do
you
that.
Never do it.
I just saw people get flushed out. I think once you're at the mercy of having to get hired for a job, like I made my own schedule. I was my own boss. Yeah. And that was so attractive to me. And I just worked too hard for too long to just take a writing job. And I think like there's so many great TV writers and movie writers. And I love that. But for me, I was too nervous to get hired again. I was too nervous to be like, well, I'm waiting on this guy to get back to me. It felt like auditioning and I don't audition. I didn't care enough. Like every part I've gotten in anything was like, hey, do you want to do this? I was like, I'll audition if it's something great, but I went into these CBS three cam sitcoms and they were so corny and not me. And I'd be like, where's the dog? And they'd be like, next. I'd be like, why did I spend the whole day on this? This
one more,
is terrible.
One more take. Yeah.
So I was just kind of like, no, I worked hard to build an audience. I was self-producing specials. I was, you know, my YouTube special that kind of propelled me to selling out clubs and then eventually to theaters was because of, you know, just believing in my stand-up enough. And it's tough. It's really tough for a lot of comics now because the it's oversaturated
and
on
so you
YouTube.
And you self-produced the YouTube one?
Yeah, that one, I got lucky and unlucky with that one because I shot it and it was scheduled to come out February of 2020. So I was like, I'm putting this out for free on YouTube. That was not a lot of comics were doing that at the time. Now a lot of comics do it because the money's in the touring. It's funny, when I did Letterman's show, he was like, you put it out for free? Where do you get that? I was like, no, because he's from the era where you needed a sitcom. But now those are harder to get. So there's actually more money in touring these days. But I put it out and I was like, free special. You put it out for free to tour. That's the, that's the, you know, way you do it. And then COVID hit and everything was shut down. I was like, well, because
I'm a genius.
but the good side of that was everyone's home and everyone watched it. So it got over 13 million views on YouTube, which is like insane for a YouTube special. And that changed my career. But then I was so panicked that I was like, everyone's going to forget my comedy by the time lockdown's over. So nothing was open in New York. The Comedy Cellar wasn't open. So I had this idea to just go perform on rooftops. I was like, if you bring beer and White Claw and your friends and a mic and an amp, I'll come to your roof. Like, you know? And then at a certain point, I started charging people because I'm like, I'm doing this for free. Right. But then I was, but I started charging people and I was like, man, this is like working. People are coming out. This is crazy. So I ended up taping a special with a drone and it was hilarious. No, we had to look up like, you can't do drones over like 37th and Madison. Like there were no drone flying areas. So we had to go to like certain areas to shoot. We're like, nope, sorry, you're in the drone zone. But we built a special with that. And I rushed that out and I was rusty. It's not my best work, but it's still a really cool thing that I'm glad I did.
Huh. Do you constantly think about comedy? Like when you're not working, we had, Keenan Thompson on last season.
Awesome.
And we talked about, you know, when you meet people, you kind of, you're in the moment, but you're also kind of paying attention to how certain people act and how they talk in case there might be some material there. You know
absolutely. Yeah. I think there's two types of comedians. There's like the always on, like can't not be funny type of comedian. And there's like the more like in your head comedian who's just like kind of studying how people act. And, I think for me, I can probably be both. I live more in the quiet. I live more in the like, let's, you know, what can I pull from here? And Colin Quinn is like a New York comic who I think is so good at observational humor. So like he'll say sometimes like, oh, the best observational jokes. You're like, how the hell did I not think of that?
Right.
You're like, that was there for all of us and he caught it. He has so many. But he had one in his New York Story special that was like how, you know, before iPhones and all this stuff, you would have to ask directions on the street in New York. And the ritual was that people don't just tell you, they have to shame you. They're like, oh, this guy doesn't even know. I'm like, that's such a great observation. Yeah. Like, how did I never think of that? It's great. But those are my, like, I have a lot that are like, this is a good observation, but what's the joke? Like, sometimes it's just like you get a recognition laugh, but it needs more, you know? Yeah. I had an observation recently. It's not enough yet, but the observation was like the friend who's always miserable that they bring you down. So they're like, how you doing? I'm like, I'm doing well. And they're like, yeah. Like they can't let you be happy. And you're like, yeah, I'm happy. And they're like, okay. I'm like, you're still doing it. You're making me sad. But that's like not an, it's more of like a observation than a joke right now.
Yeah.
It's almost there.
Your podcast. So how many years have you been doing the podcast?
Well, we started during COVID, during lockdown on Zoom. It was started because Mark and I, as I said, we're open mic friends. We've been friends for so long. I love Mark. And we would do it as like an excuse to catch up every week. We're like, the premise was when you're a young comedian, you're home. That's why you guys started this.
COVID, to catch up every week.
But, when we were young comics, you're home all the time and you're waiting to go on the road. Or, you know, you're home during the week. At first, we would drink together every night. We'd drink at the open mics. And then you get older. And you're gone every week, so you get like one night together. Because you have other two nights, you kind of just got to recover.
Yeah.
We'd have one night and we'd get really messed up because we'd just be like, this is our one night, you know? So we kept saying one more drink. And that became the name of the show, One More Drink. So that's how it started. And then we found out some other podcast was called One More Drink. But they had like 5 ratings. So we're like, no one knows them, but we should still just change it to be original.
Yeah.
So we were calling it One More Drink. And then we switched it to We Might Be Drunk. Because, you know, we don't have to be drunk every week. We have sober people on.
Right.
But you know, we just started kind of zooming and it became a fun way to catch up. And then it turned into, you know, Matt, same studio as you guys. He was like, I'll build you a studio and it looked incredible. It's got a full bar and it's fun. And I felt like people like these fly in a wall podcasts. Like, man, do people not like Zoom? I think they want you in person.
Yeah, right? No, I agree. It's way more fun. Totally. Having a discussion and just feel the energy it's so different.
Yeah, and for our Club 30 listeners, Sam's studio's across the hall and it's way cooler than ours. And I thought ours was cool.
You have a nice studio. But we've been there a while. That's all Matt though. We didn't do anything.
Yeah. Yeah. We started the same way. Catching up every Tuesday. during the lockdown.
Yeah.
Back then it was not a podcast.
It was just us getting drunk. Yeah.
That's fun though. Those are the episodes. Yeah. We did a surprise bachelor party episode for Mark where like all these comedians showed up, like Shane Gillis, Dave Attell, Godfrey, all these hilarious people showed up. And the second half of the episode, Mark and I don't think we contributed anything. We were bombed. This guy, Joe DeRosa, shows up, who's a friend of ours, and he's like that friend who you're like, oh, fuck, that guy showed up. The guy you know is going to get everyone drunk.
Yeah.
You can't just like sip a cocktail with him. He's got to order a round of shots every 3 minutes. And if you don't take it, he questions your manliness. So you're like, all right, I'll take it.
Yeah.
And then by the end, you're just the next morning, you're like, DeRosa, he got me.
Who would be a dream guest for your show? Like, is there someone that you really look up to that would be great to?
Honestly, we'd never get him because he probably would never even come to New York. But like, we like old Hollywood stories. Or I mean, we'd love to have you on. But like, I mean, Jack Nicholson would be pretty cool. Mm. That was one we wanted. We really wanted Conan because we've both done Conan a bunch of times. So he was in New York. We really wanted Conan. We wanted anyone who had like crazy stories. So Charlie Sheen, for some reason, was like a huge.
Yeah.
That was a huge want, you know, for a long time. But then we also just like love like New York. Very New York people. So,
I mean, you grew up here. So favorite spots, like outside of your work, comedy and
like restaurants.
Yeah. Like where do you tend to go when you're in the city?
I don't go out a ton. I don't go. I mean, cause you know, I'm doing shows most nights and then it's like, you don't want to be out 7 nights a week, but,
you spend a lot of time at home.
Spent a little bit. Yeah. Sometimes I'll throw a movie on. I love going to the Comedy Cellar in New York, which is like home. And I actually like their food a lot there too. So that helps. But Minetta Tavern right across is killer. Yeah. I mean, great drinks, great burgers. I love Veselka, Ukrainian spot. Great diner. Love Arturo's Pizza in Houston. A lot of downtown just in the area. Knickerbocker's cool. You know,
and you're a big sports fan.
Strip House too. I don't want to leave out Strip House. Yeah. I'm a big sports
guy.
You're
a big sports fan. I've seen you at the Garden a bunch.
Knicks, Rangers, Yankees, Giants are my teams. But I am happy when New York sports do well. But those are really the teams, you know.
Yeah. And you go to attend all these teams?
I've gone to a couple Ranger games this year. I've gone to a lot of Knicks. I'm a psychotic Knicks fan. I grew up very fortunate because the '90s. Like my intro to sports were the Rangers winning the cup and the Knicks losing in 7, which broke my heart. But when the Knicks are the only team I really root for that hasn't won in my lifetime, and I know they will. I know they have something about Brunson. Like, you know he's going to put it together. Like, this team, I just believe in this team so much. I love OG and Hardenstein and all those guys. Dante, they're just like, they're just Mitch. I love the team. The Rangers have been so fun. I'm wondering which Ranger games I went to this year. I think we saw Edmonton because my buddy's obsessed with seeing Connor McDavid live.
Yeah.
But, I mean, no, I love this Rangers team too, man. Like, Panarin's like out of his mind right now. and you got to be pumped about Igor.
I just love when both teams are doing well and you feel that energy at MSG.
Yeah. And not only MSG, like the whole city feels better.
Oh, yeah. I mean, playoffs, you know, there's so much going on in the city. So I would say a lot of fans maybe – They check in once in a while throughout the season to check on both teams, how they're doing. But then the playoff first round, it's like, okay, more eyeballs. Second round, suddenly you start to feel like you're walking into restaurants and bars. People are now really paying attention. Conference final, now you get the city really invested. I feel like that's a process in the city because there's so many things going on. But I love when, especially at the Garden, when both teams are doing well.
It's awesome. I love that you're always there, man. It's so cool when, like, you know, legends of New York sports are there, like you or Spree or, like, you know, all these New York guys. I was at the game. I was sitting next to Spree at the game against OKC recently. And every time OKC would go to the line, I wear like leather shoes usually, and I'm just stomping. Like, I stomp whenever they shoot free throws and I scream. And I got the whole section doing it, and they missed like 4 straight free throws. Like, maybe 3 out of 4 they missed. And Spree was like, he's like, it's working. I'm working. Like, this is such a hilarious thing. Yeah. I'm like, you know, riling up the section. I'm like, if you're sitting here, you better get him going. We need a hometown
part of the
advantage.
Game.
Yeah.
I love rooting for him. And the Rangers are like, I hope they didn't get hot a little too early is my only fear because their conference is loaded. You know, you got like Carolina and Boston, all these tough teams. But I do think this team is like just dangerous, man. Like, Meek is so good and Fox, all these guys.
All the parts you're looking for in terms of a great team. Yeah. You know, with structure. But then you look at goaltending, defense, offense, special teams, they have it all. So
how about this new kid who's just fight every game? It's like they gotta give him to stop fighting. Someone's gotta be like, stop fighting.
Rempe?
Yeah.
I love him.
He's
though.
A big boy. He can handle it.
Yeah, but he's gonna have a short career if he keeps going out there. Like every game, he's just like yeah, I'll fight this guy. I'm like, dude, every game, I feel like his head is like this big. And I'm like, is no one telling you to stop doing this? They need you. Yeah, because he's a good player too.
Yeah, he's a good player. I think he will definitely have an impact in the playoffs too, the way he can hit people and have a presence about him out there.
You need that dude. I mean, I remember I used to have a sports show on MSG for a minute.
Yeah, I was going to say Colton, right?
Colton taught me how to fight. Colton Orr taught me how to fight. And holy crap, I would not have wanted to take one hit. His hands are like this.
Oh, his hands. His knuckles.
He has paws.
I mean, I remember that. Like first off, it's a big knuckle. Well, his hand is huge, but they don't have the same shape as ours.
No.
Right.
You know, because they get smashed in a couple
it's like
times
a flat
hitting helmets.
Punishing machine.
He's the nicest man, but when if someone would just YouTube Colton Orr is like, I don't think he's that nice, you know, the way he fought. And
They have to prep the fight. I remember with like Danico too. I met him before and he was like, yeah, you circle days on the calendar and you're like, oh, crap, I'm going to have to fight. I'm like, man, that sucks. Like, I dread certain conversations with people. These guys are just getting their faces punched in. You know, it's brutal.
They got some real problems.
Well, hockey's such a weird combo of like grace and then just getting your face punched in. Yeah. You know, they're ice skating, but then their fight, it's such a weird to fight, have to train, because he's going to have to train Rempe in the offseason. With like some old school goons, they're gonna have to teach him because he's so young still. They're gonna have to teach him like the ins and outs of fighting on skates. It's so weird to me.
I mean, it's obviously balanced, but the so important how you grab the jersey.
Yeah,
I mean that's everything. And
get the helmet off.
You might be a good fighter, but if you don't grab the jersey the right way, that fight is over.
Yeah,
you know, you need to be able to understand how to lock the other player's arm, and obviously with Rempe, he has such a long reach, right? So that's a huge advantage.
Sure.
But also some of these little guys are tough. Some of these little guys just like get in there and you're like, what the hell? Right. They have a lower center of gravity too. So that length is also when you're, you know, trying to keep your balance.
Right. What is he, 6'7"?
Yeah, he's up there. 240 something.
Jesus Christ.
I'm scared of that.
He's awesome.
Yeah, let's hope for a great sports spring here in New York City. Yeah. And for you personally, what's going on this spring and summer?
I'm going back on tour just to, you know, I'm going to hit some clubs again to build the hour back up, and then we'll start a theater tour again. But I'm going to start in like Lexington, Kentucky. Great bourbon. Good place to have a
bourbon whiskey fan, right?
I got my own whiskey right there. You got it right there. Bodega Cat. Yeah, and then we got what else do I have? I have Brea. It's like right by LA, but it's a big room, so it's fine. I could do a few in there. And then Miami Improv. They'll show up 30 minutes late and on coke. The Miami crowds are tough. They're just like, you know, like once you get them, they're good. But like, they're like, you always got to show. Same with their sports teams. They just show up in like the second quarter. I'm like, that was an expensive ticket, you know.
Or their offices.
I know. But so then, then I got like Atlantic City with Chris DiStefano, who you saw, he was on Garden of Laughs too. We're going to do a show together, which will be fun. And then Rochester, New York, great club, upstate New York. And I got a special coming out July 9th on Amazon called You've Changed. Really, really proud of this one. Nice. Looks really cool. Most I've ever spent on a set, it looks insane. It looks like I'm in an old film noir or something. Threw a suit on and made it look, I look like Henrik at a Knicks game. I mean, I look cool in this one. But, you know,
how much work did you put into that one?
That's a couple years of touring. I usually put them out a little sooner, but I wanted to do some international dates, so that extended it. Like I did Australia, I did a little bit of Europe, and I might hit Sweden I might need on my next Euro tour in September, so I might have to get some rest.
All right.
But yeah, we'll try to hit like, you know, Denmark, Sweden, all over. Yeah.
Love it.
And then, added Australia. So you really find out which jokes are global, where you're like, I can't make this reference here. No one knows what the hell I'm talking about. Yeah. But it's funny. Some of them you're like, all right, I got to change Panda Express to like whatever bad fast food, and you're now actually don't mind Panda Express, but like New York, we're eating different Chinese food. But
When was the first time that you realized like icons were coming to your show?
That's a good question. It would happen at the Cellar here and there, but that wasn't there for me. But yeah, I'd be on the road sometimes and we'd get like a cool, like I was in LA last time and my friend's like, dude, the Red Hot Chili Peppers are here. And I was like, what? I was like, they're like, yeah, everyone but Flea. I was like, ah, Flea. I wanted Flea there too, you know?
What's it going to take to win that guy over?
But yeah, it was funny to hear. You're just like, wait, what? That guy likes me? Yeah. But then also they're just people who come seeing you, you know? Like everyone wants to laugh, as you were saying. So yeah, I get pumped when when people I like also happen to know me and like what I do. How could you not, you know?
Yeah. You want to do it forever?
Yeah, I think that's the beauty of stand-up is like, you know, look at Don Rickles and Joan Rivers. They did it till the end. Carlin did it till the end. You can do it into your 80s as long as you're still fluid, you know? So I would hope that as long as I'm not boring people, that's the risk you run. You get too old and you're just like, you're losing that ending button. And you're like, everyone's like, where the hell?
Who is it?
Yeah. Well, we've all heard those old people. I'll tell you a good Ranger story, actually. I did a gig once when I was at MSG when I had that show. They're like, do you want to do a stand-up gig at some golf course in Connecticut? And I was like, all right, sure. And it's all the Rangers. It's like, you know, Rod Gilbert is talking to me, RIP Rod Gilbert. Super nice guy. Couldn't have been cooler. Al Troutwig is like, I think he had a few that night. He was kind of like, I was like, oh, it's good to meet you, man. He goes, well, it remains to be seen how I feel about you until your act. I was like, all right, Jesus. So then I was like, I don't think Al likes me. So then, but you know, everyone there is being pretty cool. The Rangers are being really cool. And Kenny Albert is hosting. And Kenny is so cool. I love that guy.
He's the best.
He's awesome guy.
Just love the Kenny. Best guy. Yeah. And he's hosting this event. It's like the Rangers and Coca-Cola. And I go up there and I am bombing. It's going so, they won't laugh at anything I say. It's going so bad at one point I was like, give it up for Coca-Cola. And they're just like, all right. And I'm and Kenny and Albert in the corner is like dying laughing because he's like, this is going horribly. I get off stage and Kenny is like, man, that was brutal. He's the only guy who would look at me in the room. He was laughing so hard though. And he's like, we got to stay in touch. Gave me his number. We became cool after that. But Adam Graves walks up to me, and I love Adam Graves. I mean, I grew up being a Rangers fan. How do you not love Adam Graves? And he's searching. You can tell he's searching for something positive to say, but there's nothing good to say. So Adam goes, I love humor. I'm like, that's all you can give me? I love humor. That's how bad I was. I love humor.
Do we
humor.
Have any footage of this?
No, what? Thank God, no.
There's no video that we can.
It was.
Well,
it was
we have Adam Graves right outside.
Well, I talked to him. He didn't remember me, thank God. I talked to him at the Garden of Laughter a while. He's such a nice guy, and he's such a cool part of that team. I love that. You know, how do you not love these guys? You grew up on them. And I remember getting his autograph as a kid. I was really young, and I remember he was like one of the only guys who stayed and signed everyone. I'm like, what a good dude.
Yeah. He might be the nicest person I ever met. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, he's unbelievable.
He seems, I mean, he was a great player too. Just a legend, yeah.
Do you think people around you are a little hesitant to like, if I act or say a certain way, this might end up on stage, part of your routine?
You know what's funny? The people who always are like, don't put me in your act. I'm like, I wasn't going to. It's always someone who's like a realtor. They're like, they're showing you a place and they're like, I better not end up in your act. I'm like, we've been talking for 2 minutes. What are you talking? So, you know, it's always people that you're like, what?
So podcast, stand up, a few projects. But is there any acting for you?
I don't like, it's not something I'm dying to do. I'm not like, whenever someone's like, do you want to act? I'm like, hey, I don't find it really fun. If it's something I write, I'm pitching a show with my friend very soon. So if that gets made, I'll star in that. So I'm down to act in something I write. But I don't love the idea of just being an actor. It doesn't really interest me. I love the rush of stand-up and the fact that you can make a good living at this and it's my ideas and I'm telling it to the crowd and it's kind of everything I ever wanted. So, and as I said, I've seen people, you know, dabble in this, dabble in that, then they come back to stand-up and they're not really in shape, you know? Yeah. It's like, I don't want to lose
the edge.
I don't want to lose being a good stand-up. It's something like I value a lot.
Well, listen, we talked about it earlier on the show, like to make people laugh. I think it's important, especially these days. There's so much stuff going on. So I just love when you have
it's always been bad times, though. People need to laugh during the Crusades, too. You know, it's always been bad.
I just love when you have a night out.
Yeah.
And you watch a great show, how it makes you feel. Yeah. Like a great set make you laugh for like 2 hours or whatever.
Yeah.
I feel my entire body feels good. So
it feels
keep
good,
doing
man.
What you're doing.
Thank yeah, you,
we're
man.
Both really
huge
working
fans,
and
man.
Happy
yeah,
for
guys,
your success.
You guys come by the cellar sometime.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
We should.
I love that place.
Yeah, it's great, right?
It's awesome.
So no, thank you so much for coming
Thanks,
on.
Man.
And I mean we're neighbors, so we'll
see,
see
you
around.
See you for a coffee or something.
Thanks again to Sam Morrell for joining us here today at Club 30. He was funny.
I mean, that's one of those guys where I wish I had a friend who was that funny. No offense.
No offense. Right back at you.
No, but he has that vibe where he's like his presence is, you know, it's not like objectively funny, but like just the way he responds to questions and the way he interprets conversation is just different than everybody else, and you can tell why he's a legend on stage. So
yeah, no, he's crushing it, and obviously before you really make it, I could just sense it's a grind.
Yeah,
you know, he was talking about being up on stage and being able to handle the ups and downs.
Yeah,
and still believe in yourself.
Yeah,
I mean. I think obviously it's the same with everything you do, anything
yeah.
really, but to me, doing stand up and not getting the laughs, I mean, that's tough.
Yeah. I think my closing observation after that conversation with Sam is that I was jealous. And in a way that he found his thing when he was 14, 16, 17, and he never wants to do anything else because he's so like purposeful. You know, like all he wants to do is stand up. And yeah, if he sells a show and then he writes, great. But isn't it amazing that it's got to be kind of a one in a million experience where your first job is the one you want to have for the until you're 80?
Yeah.
I think that's amazing. I love the conversation.
Yeah, me too. We got to go watch him.
Yeah. Yeah, we exchange contact numbers so we can go to the cellar next time he's playing.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
I hope you guys enjoyed it at home.
Yeah.
Or whatever you listened.
Yeah, thanks for your support, guys. Always a pleasure hosting you here at Club 30, and we'll see you next week.
See you next week. Have a good one.